Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jonathan Savage, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 9th of January, these are our main stories. Queen Elizabeth's grandson, Prince Harry, has announced he and his wife Meghan are stepping back from their roles as senior members of Britain's royal family and plan to spend more time in North America. President Trump has said Iran appears to be standing down after it targeted two air bases housing US forces in Iraq. The former boss of Renault-Nissan, Carlos Ghosn, has strongly criticised Japan's judicial system in his first public comment since he fled the country, but Japan rejects the criticism.
He has been propagating both within Japan and internationally false information on Japan's legal system and its practice. This is absolutely intolerable.
Also in this podcast, vandals in northeastern Greece have defaced rock art dating back thousands of years, and a French court has announced that the former president Nicolas Sarkozy will stand trial later this year for corruption and influence peddling. We begin here in the UK, where in a surprise announcement, one of Queen Elizabeth's grandsons, Prince Harry, and his wife Meghan have announced they're stepping back from their roles as senior members of the British royal family. In a statement released on Instagram, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex say they plan to become financially independent. They intend to divide their time between Britain and North America. Last year, the Duke and Duchess began legal action against British newspapers, complaining of relentless propaganda against them. The BBC understands the couple didn't consult anyone else in the royal family before releasing the statement. Dan Wooten, the executive editor of the Sun newspaper, broke the story. He told the BBC there's been a long-running rift in the British royal family.
People don't like to hear it. It's very uncomfortable. And obviously, it's not a great thing for the institution. There is a civil war going on within the royal family over the treatment of Harry and Meghan. Harry and Meghan want to move towards, and they've said it in their statement today, you know, a more progressive monarchy. But what does that mean? What does that mean for an institution where the Queen is all about tradition? And, you know, I don't think the Queen will be happy with this statement today.
Our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond, explains what it all means.
They are talking about, and I use their words from their website at the moment, a new working model. What is clear is they are going to spend a lot more time outside Britain. They've made that clear in their original statement. North America is what they talk about. We can probably read Canada into that. They've just spent 6 weeks there. They clearly enjoyed themselves there. And they are no longer going to take part in, I think it's fair to say, the sort of institutional structure of the royal family as they have done for the last, what, couple of years. And that includes the way that they deal with the media, which is still the traditional media, the print and broadcast media of the UK. They've put out a statement again saying that they will no longer do the traditional way of dealing with the media. It means, I think, everyday activities that you might have thought that royals do, and that goes to opening hospitals and all kinds of things, they will no longer do as well. The big projects, like the Invictus Games, the games that Harry set up for injured servicemen and women, I suspect he will still want to hang on to. He showed enormous enthusiasm for that. I'd be surprised if they do royal tours anymore. I think that's very, very unlikely. But we are waiting for detail, and they say that more detail will come. But they are not quitting the royal family, but they are definitely changing the royal role.
Johnny Diamond. It was perhaps a step back from the brink. Fashionably late for his appointment with the media, Donald Trump emerged through the doors of the White House's grand foyer, the morning sunlight pouring in behind him. Then, sticking to his auto cue, he presented a message of reassurance for Americans, as well as a warning for Iran's leaders and some barely veiled criticism for several of America's traditional allies.
Iran appears to be standing down, which is a good thing for all parties concerned and a very good thing for the world. For far too long, all the way back to 1979, to be exact, nations have tolerated Iran's destructive and destabilizing behavior in the Middle East and beyond. Those days are over. Iran has been the leading sponsor of terrorism, and their pursuit of nuclear weapons threatens the civilized world. We will never let that happen.
Mr. Trump said no Americans had been hurt in Tuesday night's Iranian missile strikes and justified killing the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani, saying his hands had been drenched in blood.
Last week, we took decisive action to stop a ruthless terrorist from threatening American lives. At my direction, the United States military eliminated the world's top terrorist, Qasem Soleimani. As the head of the Quds Force, Soleimani was personally responsible for some of the absolutely worst atrocities.
President Trump also announced new economic sanctions on Iran. Our correspondent in Washington is Gary O'Donoghue. People had been looking for a de-escalation. Is that what they got?
I think they got that, if that's what they were looking for. This was a pretty measured tone throughout his speech. Yes, of course, there were threats and there was talk about these new sanctions, although Iran is pretty sanctioned as it is already, and some calls on allies to do more, in particular in terms of Iran's nuclear program. But you saw there as well a sort of appeal for peace, an appeal to the Iranian people. And I think you get a sense when you watch and listen to the whole thing that the president isn't about to launch airstrikes on Iran. We'll see what Iran's response to that will be. But at the moment, I think that the temperature has ticked down.
You might think that Iran has been sanctioned to the hilt in recent years, but what do we know about these new measures?
Nothing at the moment. We'll wait to hear from the Treasury Department on those. Typically, they would involve sanctioning extra bits of Iran's economy, although most of that is sanctioned at the moment. They may extend to other individuals in the regime. That's something that the Americans are very keen on, stopping members of the regime from getting access to assets around the world, stopping them from travelling and things like that. They do that quite a lot. So there may be some more of that. But I think, you know, in many ways, Iran has already taken the huge hit it has from sanctions, and its economy is in a mess as a result.
And what we heard today was aimed at the domestic audience, do you think?
Yes, to some extent. I mean, I think the president can present this as a victory. At the moment, he can, certainly. He's killed someone he says was a terrorist whose hands were drenched in blood. There's really been so far, and I say so far, nothing in terms of particularly effective or damaging retaliation. No American lives have been lost. We'll see if the hardliners in Iran stop at that. A lot of people think they won't.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. A French court has announced that the former president Nicolas Sarkozy will stand trial later this year for corruption and influence peddling. Mr. Sarkozy will be the first former leader to face trial for corruption in France, though another former president, Jacques Chirac, was convicted of embezzlement after leaving office. It's the latest twist in a series of criminal charges facing Mr. Sarkozy. Lucy Williamson reports from Paris.
In the tangled forest of charges and investigations that has surrounded Nicolas Sarkozy over the past few years, today's stark announcement could not be more clear. On October the 5th, Mr. Sarkozy will become the first former president to stand trial for corruption in France. He's accused of using his lawyer to try and bribe a judge to leak information about another case he was involved in. This trial only came about because police investigators tapped the former president's phone as part of a separate inquiry into whether he'd accepted millions of euros from the then Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi for his first presidential campaign. The prosecution service earlier criticised the repeated appeals made by his legal team, which it said had paralysed the investigation, and has compared Mr. Sarkozy's actions to those of a seasoned offender.
Lucy Williamson. Now, you may have heard in our earlier podcast the first public comments made by the fugitive former head of Renault-Nissan, Carlos Ghosn, who fled Tokyo for Lebanon last week. Since his arrest more than a year ago, he's not been allowed to make any public statements. So on Wednesday, his news conference in Beirut lasted more than 2 hours. He explained why he escaped.
I did not escape justice. I fled injustice and persecution, political persecution. Having endured more than 400 days of inhumane treatment in a system designed to break me and unwilling to provide me even minimal justice, I was left with no other choice but to protect myself and my family.
Accused of financial misconduct in Japan, Mr. Ghosn vowed that he would clear his name, but not in Japan, where he argues he can't get a fair trial. Speaking in Tokyo, the Japanese Justice Minister, Masako Mori, firmly rejected Mr. Ghosn's criticism.
He has been propagating both within Japan and internationally false information on Japan's legal system and its practice. This is absolutely intolerable. Japan's criminal justice system sets out appropriate procedures and is administered properly to clarify the truth while guaranteeing basic individual human rights.
But one topic remains the subject of intense curiosity. I asked our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Michael Bristow, if Mr. Ghosn had said anything about how he managed to escape.
No, in a word. But yes, it's a dramatic escape last month from Japan to Lebanon, through Turkey. Suggestions that he hid in a box, went out in a private jet. People were desperate to find out, reporters were desperate to find out exactly how he'd escaped. And he said right at the very beginning of this long press conference that he wasn't going to address that, presumably just to protect those people who helped him. He did, however, in the course of this long press conference, give a little bit of an indication of the thinking behind his decision to flee Japan. He said it was the hardest decision he'd ever made in his life. And he also said it came after a discussion with his lawyers about exactly the length of time he could be spending in Japan. And this is what he had to say.
When I left Japan, I still did not have a date for the first charge. Then they came with the idea about saying, oh, we cannot put all the trials at the same time. You have to finish the first charge before we start the second one. So when I asked my lawyers about how much time all of this is going to take, they said, we're afraid you're going to be maybe 5 years in Japan before I get a judgment.
He said at the very top it was a plot against him by Nissan executives and prosecutors in Japan. They colluded to bring these charges against him. Those charges were underreporting his income by tens of millions of dollars and misusing Nissan funds amounting to hundreds of millions of dollars. He says the accusations against him were baseless. And also he picks what he says are holes in the Japanese legal system. He was detained, questioned 8 hours a day without a lawyer, without evidence being presented against him. The authorities stopped him seeing his wife. He could see letters through glass. That's all he could see from his wife. And even when he was released, he could only see his wife in the presence of a lawyer. So he was sort of like suggesting, as many people have said before, that Japan has this hostage justice system in which people are held for indeterminate amounts of time, rearrested, and essentially coerced into pleading guilty in order to get a more lenient sentence.
So any reaction to all of this from Japan?
Prosecutors have dismissed allegations against Japan's legal system. They said it's just a one-sided testimony from Carlos Ghosn. He ought to come back. And if he really wants to clear his name, he ought to face the accusations, face the charges which were put to him and which now look as though he's going to escape because Lebanon does not have an extradition treaty with Japan. So it's going to be very hard to get him back to Japan to face these charges.
Michael Bristow. A stowaway believed to be a child has been found dead in the undercarriage of an Air France plane at Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris. The flight had arrived from the city of Abidjan in Ivory Coast. Media reports suggest the child was about 10 years old. Air France said an investigation had begun into what it described as a human tragedy. Louise Dewast reports.
Air France has confirmed in a statement that a lifeless body was found in the landing gear compartment of one of its aircrafts on Tuesday. The plane had arrived from Ivory Coast, a journey of more than 6 hours, during which outside temperatures can fall to minus 60 degrees. Landing gear compartments are not heated. French police have told news agencies that the victim was a young African, but for now the airline has not provided further details. Officials said an investigation was underway, but the incident is likely to raise questions over the security in place at the airport in Abidjan.
Louise Dewast. Vandals in northeastern Greece have defaced rock art dating back thousands of years. Pictures of animals and plants were scoured out with a wire brush. Here's our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders.
Greece is clearly not short of antiquities, but rock art is relatively rare there. It's a kind of graffiti, lines scored into the bare rock in the open air across a wild landscape. It's often quite difficult to spot, and as it's exposed to the elements, the wildlife and the human population, it has eroded over time. Some of it dates back some 5,000 or 6,000 years to the early Bronze Age. Dr. Andrea Vianello, a research fellow at the University of South Florida, has done field studies in the area. He says the damage could be substantial.
The art is quite significant because there isn't much rock art in Greece, and particularly for the early scenes, the ones that probably dated between Neolithic and Bronze Age, they are fairly unique to the area. So if the loss involves those scenes, this is a disaster.
The art that's been damaged is near the coastal city of Kavala. It was discovered in 1966. It has never been given state protection. Some people feel that it inhibits their use of the surrounding land. One local archaeologist even has a theory that treasure hunters wanted to obliterate clues mentioned in an ancient legend, as Dr. Vianello explains.
There is a local history that there was a hidden treasure in the area and that the rock art would point to it. But I would say that the main reason for this happening is that they wanted to reclaim that land for their own use. And since the state and the local authorities haven't protected or promoted very well that area, there was no tourism and no economic benefit in having these rocks.
Dr. Vianello says that a balance has to be struck between preserving cultural heritage and making a living.
Mike Sanders. Still to come on this podcast, new information about how people in the only part of the British Isles to come under Nazi control resisted occupation. Best of friends. That's what Ursula von der Leyen says Britain and the European Union will remain even after Brexit. A partnership of zero trade tariffs and zero quotas. That's what the head of the European Commission says she's aiming for. But in a speech in London, she warned that there could be no compromise on the integrity of the single market and the customs union.
Without the free movement of people, you cannot have the free movement of capital, goods and services. Without a level playing field on environment, labour, taxation and state aid, you cannot have the highest quality access to the world's largest single market. The more divergence there is, the more distant the partnership will be.
Then she held talks with the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. I asked our political correspondent, Rob Watson, what had been discussed.
They basically set out, it would appear, their fundamental positions. You really heard the EU's position there from Ursula von der Leyen, which is essentially, look, time is short for negotiating an agreement. Mr. Johnson wants to do it before the end of the year. And that basically you, the UK, are not going to get as good a deal outside the EU than in it. And Mr. Johnson evidently repeated his government's position, and that is that it wants to settle a free trade deal with the European Union by the end of this year, and that there won't be any extensions, and the UK won't follow the EU's rules.
What's the importance of her saying no compromise on the single market and customs union?
Well, I think it's hugely important. I mean, I think this is the EU saying to Mr. Johnson and to the UK in general, look, you're going to have to wake up. You're not going to be able to have your cake and eat it. You know, if you want to have great access to the European Union's markets, you're going to have to follow our rules. You'll have to align with us, something that Mr. Johnson has ruled out. In other words, what the EU is rather worried about is a sort of a UK off the coast of Europe, a sort of Singapore on Thames, a competitor off the coast of Europe, not playing by the rules, but wanting, as they would see it, the same kind of access.
They sound friendly, but is the trust there?
I think they are friendly. Look, I'm not sure that the word trust is the right one, really. I think that the dynamic has been the same, really, Jonathan, since the moment Britain voted to leave the European Union, with essentially Britain wanting all the things that it liked about its membership of the European Union, so great access to trade, expertise, all that kind of things. None of the things it didn't like, paying in the money, applying by the rules of an EU court, and being part of a political club. And the EU has always said, look, you're just not going to have as good a deal outside the club than in it. And I think the next few months are going to be about who gives gives ground. I mean, clearly they've staked out their maximum positions, but over the next few months, who is going to have to give way a bit?
That was Rob Watson. Thousands of camels in South Australia are to be shot dead from helicopters as a result of extreme heat and drought. A five-day cull started on Wednesday as Aboriginal communities in the region have reported large groups of camels damaging towns and buildings. Some feral horses will also be killed. Camels aren't native to Australia. They were brought over by British settlers from India, Afghanistan and the Middle East in the 19th century. Estimates of their numbers vary, but there are thought to be hundreds of thousands of them across central parts of the country. Jonathan Head reports.
The cost to animals from Australia's bushfires is still being calculated. Thousands of farm livestock and hundreds of millions of wild animals are thought to have died. Now the authorities in South Australia say they need to kill 10,000 camels in the remote northwest of the state. Australia has the world's largest population of wild camels, introduced in the 19th century to help travel in the desert. The long drought of the past two decades is driving the animals to leave the desert and seek water on farms, damaging crops, taps, even air conditioning units. In the past, camels have been rounded up and sold for meat, but the authorities say the population has now grown too large. They plan to shoot the camels from helicopters and have promised they will be killed humanely.
Jonathan Head. Aid agencies are warning that drought in the southern African country of Zambia has left more than 2 million people in need of food aid. Late rains last year came on the back of poor rains and a failed harvest, meaning many people, mainly subsistence farmers, have simply run out of food. Whilst drought does happen from time to time in Zambia, it's very unusual to see such levels of suffering. This is the first time in 15 years that the UN's World Food Programme has been required to provide food aid there. As Andrew Harding reports from Zambia, the experts are blaming climate change.
The noise you can hear is of people scrambling to collect sacks of maize flour that have been laid out, hundreds of them, in the centre of Lusumpuko village. Aid agencies who've delivered this food are saying that this part of Zambia is suffering from severe malnutrition levels that are one level below that which would trigger famine warnings. So Esther Simamvwa has just come over. She's 65, and you're queuing like everyone else, waiting for the food aid. When did you last eat?
Maybe it is almost 2 days past.
How are you feeling?
I'm feeling very weak.
What did you eat?
Wild fruits.
Wild fruits.
Yes.
Do you remember it being this bad before in your life?
Living like this, it is our first time. Nowhere to get food. Even if those who are having money, where to get food, there is nowhere.
Oh, you're good there?
Yeah.
At the local clinic here, a health worker has set up a set of scales on a tree branch and he's weighing some of the local children.
He's weighing 6-pointer.
6.7.
What should she be weighing?
For 10 months, she's supposed to be at 9 kilograms.
She's over 2 kilograms underweight.
Yeah.
The nurse here is Nancy Mwape.
It's bad because this is one of the areas that doesn't have malnourished children.
Normally?
But yes. Okay, the normal, I would say, would be 5 cases, but now the number has gone up.
To how many?
I think they've reached 20 or more, if I'm not mistaken.
And why is it happening?
There's no food. People didn't manage to harvest anything last year.
Now, Zambia has suffered from droughts in the past. It's something that happens in this part of Africa. But the concern is that the droughts are getting more severe, less predictable, and much harder to cope with. And the reason for that is climate change. Alan Mulando is a programme officer with the World Food Programme.
Number one, the rain patterns have actually changed over the number of years. In the last 15 years, the effective start of the rain season was October. As we speak now, the effective start of the rain season is mid-December. The second part is the distribution of the rainfall itself. It's actually extremely erratic now. It's one place here, it rains 10 kilometers, there's nothing.
So the weather becoming more unpredictable and more extreme, that's not just business as usual, that's climate change.
Absolutely. Now, there's also an element of the human induced kind of exacerbation. There's been a lot of deforestation going on, okay, which is actually contributing to the speeding up on the changes. So that is actually driving the climate change aspects as well.
People are now starting to take the food aid back to their homes, dragging big bags, putting smaller ones on their heads. We're told there's enough for about 1,800 people to last a month. But this is a crisis that many people believe is going to last for quite some time. I can see big black clouds here. There has been some rain, but not enough yet. And the concern is that there are at least 3 months before the crops are going to be ready in the fields to harvest. And so a lot of people could still be very hungry for quite some time here.
That report from Andrew Harding. In Britain, the government has called on the English Football Association to review its decision to sell broadcast rights to the FA Cup via a third party to the Bet365 gambling website. The FA Cup is the oldest annual knockout competition in the football world. The government minister in charge of sport, Nicky Morgan, wants to see the contract terminated. My colleague Sarah Montague asked Mark Palios, the former chief executive of the Football Association and current chairman of League One side Tranmere Rovers, for his views.
I think most people nowadays would accept that this is not something that I think the football desperately wants to get involved with, but actually football does have a long-standing and quite a deep relationship with the gambling community. I think from the FA's perspective, it's inconsistent with their stance now on mental health, etc., and the linkages between mental health and gambling are there for everybody to see. So I think it's a function of the timing of this. I think that could they actually redress it straight away at the moment? Probably not, because of privity of contract. I would imagine the FA has a contract with IMG. IMG has a contract with Bet365. So to unravel it straight away is going to be quite difficult. So I think the timing of this is unfortunate for them. But going forward, almost certainly they will not want to include in their sponsorships. We as a club ourselves, we have a demographic in Birkenhead with some of the poorest areas of the country. And we've been approached, despite our financial difficulties over the last few years, we've been approached by betting companies, and we simply said it was something for us not to do. Whilst the game may be involved, I think clubs have to make their own decision as to whether they get involved. And for us, we decided against it.
Well, can I ask why? Because there will be people who say, look, the only reason I'm able to watch this match is because Bet365 are putting a load of money into it, and therefore I can watch it. And yes, I may have on the side of my screen the opportunity to bet on it. But that's a price worth paying. What do you say?
Well, I can only speak for ourselves on this. And we proudly say we're Wirral's family club, and it's rooted in the community. I think it's well established, the linkage between gambling and the problems that makes for a community itself in terms of breakdown of marriages and families and so forth and so on. And so it was purely a personal decision by this club to do that, to distance itself. And if the fans, I think the fans realise that, they understand, they don't need to have that by the side of the screen. I just think it's for me, it's entirely inconsistent to force somebody to make a payment. Whether it's to make a bet or it's just to make access to the opportunity to make a bet on something that we know that we really have to look after in society. I think the phrase that, when the fun stop, is all well and good for the betting community to say that. But the reality is, if the fun stops, you're well past that point.
That's Mark Palios, the former chief executive of the Football Association in England. The Channel Islands lie between Britain and France. Now, new information, which had previously been shut away for decades, has been casting light on the levels of defiance there under Nazi occupation during the Second World War. The islands of Jersey and Guernsey were invaded by Hitler's forces in 1940 and occupied for 5 years. They were the only parts of the British Isles to come under German rule in the war. David Lewis has the details.
The newly released files bring to light some of the most extraordinary acts of defiance from ordinary islanders 75 years after the end of occupation. Among the crimes that Nazis clamped down on were the daubing of V for Victory signs, listening to illegal radio broadcasts, and the spreading of anti-German propaganda. Sentences varied. Two of the youngest prisoners, schoolgirls Kathleen Duckworth and 14-year-old Beryl Wickens, were both convicted of unspecified political offences and held for a night in custody. Philip George Ozard was found guilty of unauthorised weapon possession and sentenced to 5 years forced labour in France and Germany. He was only released at the end of the war. Another islander, Louisa Gould, who'd been found guilty of hiding a Soviet prisoner of war on the island, was sent to Ravensbrück concentration camp outside of Berlin, from where she never returned. A register kept by the Nazis at the island's prison contained the names of 506 individuals who committed political crimes. Some of those charged were sentenced by German troop courts, specially established in Jersey during the occupation to try people for crimes committed against the Germans.
David Lewis. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jonathan Savage. Until next time, goodbye.